distributing the Future Broadcast May 8, 2006 summer projects.
The future is going to be bigger than the past. There's going to be more happening. Connected systems, connected devices, connected data. What can we do in that world that will be interesting, powerful, and useful?
Changing the world through capturing the knowledge of innovators.
The future is here. It's just not evenly distributed yet.
Welcome to Distributing the Future from O'Reilly Media. I'm Daniel Steinberg, and each week we bring you the technology and the people behind what you use now and what you'll use next. Are you looking for something fun or interesting to do this summer? This week we begin with an interview with Julianne Cost, whose pictures from airplanes are published in the book Window Seat. Then Google's Chris DiBona talks to us about the upcoming second summer of code. And finally, Dale Doherty reads from his article in Make magazine on Natalie Jeremijenko and her robot dogs. Summertime is a great time to change your schedule a bit and look for a project to take on. There are more hours of daylight, more hours that you can put into something different and interesting. Try different things and you'll know when it feels like one of your fun avocations has turned into a project. That's how it was for Adobe's Julianne Cost. She began taking pictures out of airplane windows as she flew from one venue to another. At some point, she realized she had hundreds of pictures worth keeping and that she had embarked on a personal project. She begins by explaining how she got started.
Well, I first started taking pictures out of the airplane window because I was scared to death of flying. And I took a trip in Las Vegas with a video camera. We did a little trip at the Grand Canyon. And I realized that if the video camera was between me and the actual outside world, it was like I was removed from it. I was just a spectator of it. And so I thought, maybe while I'm flying, because I'm so afraid of flying, maybe I can go ahead and put a camera between me and what's really going on out there and kind of lessen the impact and kind of lessen my fear. Now, I won't say that like really cured my fear of flying. In fact, I'm still afraid to fly. But this project was, that's how it started off. And I never expected really when I started it in the beginning to make a book out of it. That's just something that evolved over time. When I first started, I just started taking pictures of everything out the window because like I said, it was more of a distraction. And then all of a sudden, you know, I was shooting film at the time, so it got to be kind of an expensive distraction. And so then I started kind of narrowing my focus and I found that I actually had, you know, like 5 or 6 good images, and then it was 8 or 10 good images, and then all of a sudden I had 20 images, and I thought, wow, you know, maybe I could actually have a show or something. And that was early, you know, like probably in 2000. And then since then, the collection has just grown, and I think one of the reasons that I'm so interested in it is just that the job that I took at Adobe about 6 years ago involves so much travel. And basically when you travel for work, at least in my case, you know, everyone thinks it's very, very glamorous, but the majority of your days you're in transportation. You're either in a car, you're in a hotel room, you're in a conference room, you're eating meals, or you're in the air flying. There was nothing that I could find in those environments that I wanted to take pictures of, but I needed a creative outlet, and that turned into this project. The salt flats out of SFO are phenomenal, and in fact, because I always fly out of San Jose, but I know that if you sit on the right-hand side of the plane, as you take off in the morning, the sun is on the right-hand side, but you bank really quickly. And if you bank quick enough, it'll actually take you over this really interesting part of the salt flats. In fact, there's a photo of those. There's 2 photos of those in my book. And then there's also photos going into San Francisco, like you were mentioning, the really bright red salt flats. You know what's amazing about the fact that I have flown from San Jose to Denver at least 100 times, and I don't think they ever fly in exactly the same spot. Because I will see something one trip, there's no way I'll ever see in any other trips. For example, I have flown, you know, into San Jose so many times, and yet I've only flown over Yosemite twice. So I don't know what has to happen with the weather in order to change that flight path, but it's great. I mean, I don't actually have a picture of that in the book, and so that's one that I would like to get. There's still more images that I would love to collect, but I did find, as the project continued, that I'd see a fluffy cloud, but I think, well, I already have, you know, a really good fluffy cloud. So then I actually think that made me look even harder for something that was different. I'd love to know where I am. And that's one of the reasons that I kept track of every flight that I was on. So every photograph, the title of it is actually the flight that I was on. I could just kick myself now because I think I could have just had some kind of adapter or something for my camera that would have just recorded GPS, and that would have been just amazing. That would have been so cool to know exactly where it is. One of the things that I love about photography and taking images is that I like to take photographs of things that maybe other people can't see, or the day they don't see, so we can be in the same room, we can be on the same flight, whatever it is, but I see something that you don't, and I absolutely love it when someone comes up to me and they're like, well, what's that of? And you tell them, and they're like, wow, like, I was there, I didn't see that, or you know, I'm going to look for that next time. They've taken on a life of their own. They, you know, in the beginning, I was just shooting them for my own personal project, and I want to emphasize here that I think that everybody should have a personal project. The whole beginning of the book is based on the creative process and how to stay creative when you're maybe not in a creative environment, and I think that everybody needs to really have their own personal project that they're working on, no matter how silly it seems to other people, because it's going to be rewarding to them, and that's really what matters, in my opinion. So I gathered this collection of images up, and I naively thought, oh, I can self-publish this, and then I really decided that was a really bad idea, because then it would just be like one picture after another, and I wanted something that would tie the book together. So I was very, very fortunate, and Steve Weiss at O'Reilly came up to me, and he'd seen the images, and he really liked them, and we started talking, and he paired me with an editor, Edie Friedman, and I think it's one thing to take a photograph, but it's another thing to sequence photographs. And Edie's background in design and her ability as a technical editor, she just arranged these images just absolutely beautifully. I'm pretty linear as far as my thinking, so the only ways I could think to arrange the photographs were really either by date, like by time, like, oh, that's an old one, this is a new one, or by location, like, okay, this is West Coast to East Coast, or by time of day, or by color maybe. But she just arranged them in just a completely different way than I would have ever thought to, and her ability to pair different images together is just beautiful. I'm so amazed how many people take pictures on the plane, and the only reason that I say that I'm amazed is because you never see anyone doing it. Like, I've never seen anyone taking pictures out of the plane. In fact, I've often thought, what on earth are these people thinking of me taking pictures out of the plane? Like, gee, it must be her first flight ever. She's so giddy and she's taking pictures out of the plane window. And that's just not true. I mean, I've got, you know, way too many miles for a normal person to have. But yeah, no, I'm so encouraged. I'm so happy that so many people come up and they say, like, I take pictures out of the plane, or they do another project. In fact, I had someone at Photoshop World who came up to me and said, you know, I take pictures out of the plane window, and my family's so tired of seeing them that they said, you know, stop that, why are you taking them? And they were getting all this flack, and then he saw these images, and he was like, yeah, you know what, that's right, that is my personal project, that's what I want to do. And so I just want to encourage everybody to follow. You know, I didn't have any expectations of this becoming a book at the very beginning, but it was just what I wanted to do. So I just encourage people to follow their heart, and if they have a project that they want to follow for years and years and years, that they should just do it. I would say that at any given time, I have quite a few projects that I'm working on, but I know when they become a real project. This became a project, like an official project in my mind. I don't know. As soon as I got above 100 images that I really liked, I thought, wow, this is really a project. And then it became, you know, more and more challenging, and I could focus in on things that I didn't have. And then when I would see something different from the plane, I would get really excited about it. And, you know, sometimes you fly at night, and that's a real bummer, or you don't get a window seat, or you're on the wrong side. That's the worst, is when you're on the wrong side of the plane, and the pilot comes on and he's like pointing out something. If you're on the left side of the plane and you're on the right side of the plane, and there's nothing you can do about it. The images need a ton of processing. Afterwards, there's just so little contrast when you're taking pictures. Well, first of all, there's the problem of there's so many pieces of, well, it's not glass, but the windows themselves, you know, it's not just one, it's multiple pieces, and sometimes you get this weird moiré pattern through it. So really, you have to take off everything except for the lens. You know, I make sure there's no polarizer or anything on the lens, and then I open it up so that it's like f4 or f2 or however far, you know, you can open up the aperture, so that you can focus on the clouds. And, you know, otherwise, if you had this incredible depth of field, then you'd focus on the window, and then you get all the dirt on the window. And personally, I have enough dirt on my sensor that I really don't want to deal with more dirt on the window. So those are some of the things you can do. It's one of the difficult things is reflections. So I try to sit on the non-sunny side of the plane. So I kind of actually do think about it when I'm getting my seat assignment. You know, if I want to sit on the left side or the right side of the plane. Other things that I think about, it was a little bit easier, you know, pre 9/11, you know, to get on the plane and kind of put like a black sweatshirt over my head as I'm looking out the window to get rid of glare. And, you know, and I don't want to unnerve anybody, and I don't want to do anything that causes tension. So I just don't do that anymore. I just try to use my hand, or I actually try to wear something dark when I fly. Just keeping that in mind.
We link to Julianne Koff's book Window Seat in the show notes at O'ReillyNet.com/future. Chris DeBona might just have the best job in the country right now. I don't know. I end up thinking that about a lot of the people we talk to here on DTF, and then it occurs to me that I get to talk to all these people, so maybe I have the best job around right now. Chris is the open source guy at Google, and last year he was given a pot of money and a problem to solve. You've got all these computer science students who need to earn money in summers. Why not keep them busy writing code? Chris matched 400 college students with 40 companies and organizations who had projects for these students. Google was paying for the students to work on open source projects, and Chris says it was a big success. This summer, there are more students and many more organizations involved. You can hear how excited he is as he explains to us over the phone.
What happened was when I started Google, the founders asked me to consider the problem of students that don't get to work on computer science over the summer, and to think about those that are sort of stuck getting a job with burgers or whatever. They had a certain budget in mind for it. And so I was like, okay, well, they're asking the open source guy this question. They obviously wanted to have something to do with open source, and anyways, that's what I know. So I thought to myself, well, how do I do that? How do I take that much money? Because if I bring on people myself or have like some pseudo-internship program, it's going to be weird. So I thought to myself, well, you know, why don't I just call all my friends? So Greg Stein and I started calling our pals and saying, what do you think about us sponsoring students for you? And as we thought more about it, we came up with the idea of Summer of Code, computer scientist coding. Not that we think that it's being stagnant or anything like that, but you know, we really wanted to inject, you know, a lot of fresh blood and maybe, you know, at the end have people who are just competitors. And so what we did is we invited a whole bunch of groups. We ended up having, you know, everything from FreeBSD to LiveJournal to Fedora Core to languages like Python. And we said, okay, guys, we need a list of ideas from you. This is the things that they want their students to work on, right? And we don't approve these. These all exist on their side. You know, basically the idea is think about what normally takes you about 3 weeks and make that a summer-long project. Because if you think about it, someone coming into a project, they have to learn the ways of the project and code itself, and then maybe they can start contributing, right? So, you know, suppose you're Ben Laurie working on some security project. Well, you know, okay, so Ben Laurie's got all this backed up knowledge in his head, but someone new to the project doesn't have that at all. Maybe they just have the desire to learn. So we want to get past that and then have them actually give something, you know, functional and fundamental to the project. So they put up these ideas, but, you know, the things weren't limited just to the ideas. Other students proposed things that were wholly new or different or just even barely connected to the group themselves. And a number of these people were accepted. And so yeah, I think it worked out to be about half people who just were working on the ideas as set forth by their project, and another half were just people who came up with their own thing. So that's what happened last year. And it worked out pretty well. They selected who they were going to work with, what they were going to do. And then if they did it, well, they got paid. So just getting accepted, you got $500. But finishing and doing what you said you were going to do, you would get another $4,000. So it was a good amount of money. We didn't want to have a thing where you would just get money for wanting it. Right. You know, realistically, we know that when somebody is giving away somebody else's money, they're going to be a little more generous. So real risk success rate, we'll call it 70%, 75%, which was way more than I was expecting. And I was really, really happy to see. And so we were like, okay, well, let's look what happened last night. Is there any way we can make it better? Right. So, of course, we can make it a little bigger, which we're doing. You know, somewhere around 600 or 700 students. We can take on more projects. So last year we had 40, but a lot of them were like onesie twosies, and then Apache was like 30K. And it's like, you know, I love giving Apache that many students, but I don't want to stop that. But I want to have more smaller projects. For the most part, someone like Apache has no problem attracting developers. Even though they're really important, I want to help, you know, someone like Dojo. You know, they could use a couple. And more importantly, they could use the exposure, and they could, you know, they could do with exposing students to their kind of development. So we have more projects. We have more slots for students, therefore more money to pay them. And it's really nice. See, the other side thing about this that's really cool is we get to give a donation to these groups for every student they handle. So suppose a group handles 10 students. Well, we get to give them $500 per student, which they can then use to for their own goal. It's a great program. I really love it. I think the sweet spot for the program is sort of late college, like, say, junior year on, and, you know, master's. And that's pretty good because, you know, there's a certain amount of computer science you kind of have to know before you don't make bad mistakes with software. So, for instance, like Internet 2, right? Suppose you write an algorithm that's like, you know, an order n squared kind of algorithm. It can take a long time to complete. Well, if you drop that in the middle of a very time-sensitive routine, that could be pretty bad for a project, right? So, you know, balancing, you know, which ones are more algorithmic versus others. You know, this year, the kind of data I want to collect is vastly expanded from last year. I want to figure out, like, sort of, you know, the age grouping for the per project, you know, and stuff like that. Because last year, we only had a very tenuous sort of grasp of those kinds. And so, you know, I can tell you how many succeeded and, you know, how many countries they were in, but I couldn't tell you, like, you know, the average age is 20 and a half years or 24 and a half or 18 and a half. We're doing a lot more data collection this time around. They have to either be accepted into an accredited institution for some definition of accredited. The reason we did this is that we thought to ourselves, okay, we can just open this up to anybody, or we can target students. And the reason we ended up going after students is that traditionally Google has done a very good job of attracting students at a very rarefied strata of school. But there's a lot of, like, these people who are maybe not at, you know, a name school like that, but are actually really terrific developers. So how do we find them? If you think about it, open source is a great way of getting people to work on something bigger than their degree, right? Bigger than their school's reputation, and sometimes bigger than their country's reputation. You think about these really small countries sometimes, they're dotted all over the world. Well, you know what? There's developers there, and some of them are really good. And so we were thinking, okay, well, we could just open up to the whole world, but, you know, we were kind of scared of that, and we didn't really know what we were doing. And so we decided to go with students. And it turns out that this was a pretty good idea, because there's a lot of great computer scientists just waiting in school, and they're always looking for opportunities. So it was a pretty great place to target. Now, that said, you know, next year we want to find something that works for people who are in high school. And then, you know, what do we do outside of school? That's a good question. Since we want this program to be international, what is high school? You know, so it's funny the kind of definitions that you take for granted when you're creating a program like this. You know, it's like, you know, what is a student? You know, a student who's gotten their A-levels in Great Britain, just in the middle of applying for a school in, you know, Germany, are they qualified? And so we have this fairly flexible sort of way of saying yay or nay if somebody can actually take part. You know? And then you get this thing as, okay, who's the teacher? And then there's this part of you in the back of your head that says, oh, who cares? If they can make a great application, we can make an exception if it's a great application. And since it is one of those things that if you actually don't do what you say you're going to do, you're not going to get the big payment, right? So there's not a lot of harm in taking risks and being flexible about sort of the nature of people's qualifications with a program like this. Because at the end, you know, Google's out $500. Because, you know, so leading into this year, what we did is we told the people last year, hey, we're going to do this again if you want to apply. And here's a poster that you can poster your college with or whatever. We'd really appreciate it. And I'd like to be able to have them not just us leverage them, but them leverage each other. All students will be accepted or rejected the 22nd of May. Even if you don't make it in this year, try next year. And we're always doing interesting things around open source. So check us out.
Google's Chris DeBona on Google's Summer of Code. Last week, we talked to Make Magazine's Dale Doherty about the Maker Faire. The Make podcast feed republished a story that Dale wrote and narrated on Natalie Jeremijenko and her robot dogs, and we've edited it down here. You'll find a link to the original story in the show notes.
We take in abandoned robotic dogs, says Natalie Jeremijenko. She gets a warm laugh from a room full of geeks at O'Reilly's Emerging Technology Conference, ETEC, in San Diego this past March. Most people tire of their robotic dogs and end up selling them on eBay. We need to rethink toys, she adds. Most of them are not truly engaging and have very little ability to teach us anything about the world we live in. Her idea is to release these domestic robots into the wild where, in the case of the Feral Robotics Project, hacked toy dog robots could interact with each other and with humans as they sniff out contaminants in a landfill. I work on examining the cultural opportunities that technological innovations provide, she explains. I want to explore what's been left out of social robotics, which is more than having a handful of robots in a room. What does it mean to think of social robots, not just in terms of the robots, but in terms of the people, too? Can we re-script our interactions with nature, she asks. Instead of hunting geese, we can approach and talk to them and likely annoy them. Jeremijenko experimented with a robotic goose that can play with, chase, and terrorize other geese. She says that this project is an example of using the open structure of participation and that interacting with a goose is much better than playing inside a closed system, such as a video game. Another project allows people and fish to communicate. A board is placed in water with a hole above the waterline and a hole below the waterline. When a hand reaches inside the top hole, say to feed fish, the light goes on, telling fish that a human is there to feed them. When a fish passes through the lower hole, the light also goes on, letting a human know that there is a fish waiting to be fed. This shows you how technologies can be used to create an architecture of reciprocity, Jeremijenko remarks. Jermajenko's projects have more in common with performance art than with traditional science experiments. They are purposely designed to engage an audience and evoke a response. On the day we caught up with Jermajenko, she was planning to have her class release a pack of feral robotic dogs on the Mission Bay landfill in San Diego. Local media, along with political figures, were invited. As we trail along, Jermajenko pops her head into the room designed as an art studio that serves as the students' shared lab space. "Will you be ready in 5 minutes?" she asks. Nobody answers. The students' heads are focusing down on their robotic dogs, which suffer a variety of last-minute problems. Some students are soldering, others are twisting wires. When Jermajenko asks the same question again, the resounding reply is no. Tristan Schoen, the teaching assistant, shuffles from one group to the next, trying to figure out which dogs are close to working and which are unsalvageable. The 9 students work for about 3 to 4 weeks on the project after first locating their abandoned dogs. They consult web pages that tell them how to find dogs and upgrade them. There are 3 basic upgrades. The first is to increase their range of motion. This involves gently amputating the legs, Jermajenko says, and lowering the center of gravity, as well as widening the wheelbase. A simple way to do that is to fit the robotic dog onto a chassis of a used RC car, as Chen's group did. The second upgrade is to give the dog a better brain. The class used the Cockroach 2 microcontroller and wrote some C code and then found a way to attach the logic board to the dog. The goal is to have the dog's brain follow its nose, which is the third upgrade, a nose that can sniff out environmental toxins. Each dog was outfitted with a sensor that measures the amount of solvent vapor in the air. Depending on the level of toxicity, the sensor will output a different voltage. "We have to go now," comes the professor's final instruction. The students begin placing their dogs and spare parts in laundry baskets and rush out to the cars for a 20-minute drive to the Mission Bay landfill. In addition to UCSD, there are feral robotic projects at Cornell University and in Dublin, London, San Francisco, and Brisbane, Australia. "We are forming an online distributed community," explains Jermajenko, "which is interested in the low-cost adaptation of robotic dogs into activist instruments for exploring the local environment." Her goal is to release the dogs on sites of community interest, such as Mission Bay. "This site was used by local military contractors," she adds, "where they dumped several thousand barrels in an unlined landfill right next to SeaWorld. It's at the former mouth of the San Diego River, so there's a good deal of groundwater." When we arrive at the site, Jermajenko was surprised by the number of video cameras and journalists. The landfill is also used as an airstrip for remote-controlled airplanes, and throughout the day, these hobbyists seem irritated by the presence of both the dogs and the people. If that wasn't annoying enough, the students are launching a large red balloon, which is outfitted with a rig to hold a video camera and is steered into position by ropes. The balloon captures a god's-eye view of the track. At the release of the feral dog pack, only one of the 5 seems to be actually work as expected. It's Mia Mia, the furry one, the one least likely to become feral. Others are experiencing fits before starting. The wheels spin, and soon most of them are spreading out over the dirt. Each dog's brain contains space-filling algorithms that describe how to cover the territory and what to do when they detect a toxic substance. Jermajenko explains that since the dogs are programmed to respond to toxins, humans can learn by watching this response. It provides people with evidence. None of the dogs actually senses any sign of the contaminants on the site. The release of a gas from a canister used for testing is discovered by Qian's iCybe robot. This dog circles back following its nose and runs into the canister and stops. Later at eTech, Jermajenko says, because the dogs follow the concentration gradients, they display the information with their movements. Anyone, from a 4-year-old to a grandmother, can understand what the dogs are doing. Finally, she adds, what happens when you change who has the evidence? You change the structure of participation between the expert audience and the lay audience. People can become the experts, and you know what? They are.
Dale Doherty narrating his story about Natalie Jermajenko and her robot dogs. Thanks also to Julianne Cost and Chris DeBona. Thanks to all of you who've emailed in your comments, criticisms, and suggestions. If you have ideas to share with us, send email to future@oreilly.com. I'm Daniel Steinberg. Distributing the Future is a production of O'Reilly Media. Special thanks to David Bettino for composing and performing this theme. Visit David at Batmosphere.com. This program was produced on Mac OS X Tiger using Soundtrack Pro, Bias Peak, and Audio Hijack Pro.